Welcome to this session. I'm Levina Fielding Anderson, and I have a personal interest in these particular authors, meaning this particular critic, so I'm delighted to introduce it. This session could also be titled Morlix at Sunstone, since Polly Aird and Gary Topping are both members of a small but vigorous group of Catholics who do Mormon studies and hang out at places like the Mormon History Association and Sunstone. Even Kurt Bench, who masquerades as a mild-mannered high counselor by Sunday, is a latitudinarian, meeting with a group small enough to fit around the table at the Spaghetti Factory by Friday. Why are these two very devout Catholics doing Mormon studies? And is the fact that they're still devout Catholics a revelation of just how inadequate our fellowshipping is? And why are both of their books being published by Arthur H. Clarke Company, which is currently headed by a descendant of Daniel H. Wells? These are obviously topics that lend themselves to serious consideration by conspiracy theorists. All kidding aside, these are the books in question. Leonard Arrington, A Historian's Life, and Mormon Convert, Mormon Defector, A Scottish Immigrant in the American West, by Polly. These books are important not only to the burgeoning field of Mormon studies, but also to the theme of this year's Sunstone, A Maturing Faith. What do these two books have to tell us about faith, and particularly about faith as it grows up out of the simplicity of childhood and the emotional angst of adolescence? Kurt gets to ask these and other questions, but I get to see that they get answered. Now, both of these books are available at Benchmark, at the book room, and here are some flyers on Polly's book, for those of you who would like to dip into that before you dip into the books themselves. And they are excellent value. Kurt wouldn't sell anything else. Gary Topping is the author of Leonard Arrington, A Historian's Life. Gary is professor of history at Salt Lake Community College and archivist of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. He has written some 36 professional articles and 10 books, mostly about Utah and Western history, including most recently The Story of the Cathedral of the Madeleine. He is a member of the Advisory Board of Editors of Utah Historical Quarterly. His writings have won Best Article and Best Book awards from the Utah State Historical Society and the Mormon History Association. He turned to the topic of a literary biography of Leonard J. Arrington, Mormon's preeminent new historian and happy warrior of Mormon studies, to borrow Ron Walker's characterization of him. And I wouldn't say that I worship the ground Leonard walked on, but I will say that I'm very fond of it. So I was enthusiastic to the point of incoherence about Gary's 2003 study of Mormon historians and the reconstruction of Western history that analyzes the historical contributions of Bernard DeVoto, Dan Morgan, Juanita Brooks, Wallace Stegner, and Fawn Brody. So even though I sent Gary encouraging emails when he said he wanted to work on Leonard, I awaited the outcome with apprehension. Obviously, if Gary was going to be mean to Leonard, I was going to have to hang around outside the cathedral and firebomb his car. In addition to a major chapter on Leonard's Great Basin Kingdom, Gary singled out some of Leonard's contract biographies and less well-known works as revealing more of Leonard's personal research and writing style before moving on to those books in which Leonard assumed the role of historical entrepreneur, a trait that Gary justly praises, along with Leonard's amazing optimism and versatility. I think, however, by working backwards from the works to the man, Gary may not have given adequate attention to Leonard's really amazing leadership and generosity. People followed him because they truly loved him and shared his vision of Mormon history. Maybe you just had to be there when Camelot happened. Polly Aird is an independent historian who lives in Seattle, Washington, but finds numerous occasions to fly eastward to check on two truly adorable grandchildren. Ella the Elegant, and Wilkie the Dumpling. A member of the editorial board of the Journal of Mormon History, she is the author of several award-winning articles published in the Utah Historical Quarterly, the Nevada Historical Quarterly, the Journal of Mormon History, and Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Ask her about the Parrish Potter murders in Springville if you want to lose your lunch, and a few illusions about whether it really was all just nasty Gentile rumors that those Mormons actually blood-atoned apostates. Polly was formerly manager of technical communications for the computer sciences division of Boeing Company in Seattle. Besides Mormon Convert, Mormon Defector, published in June 2009, Polly is editor with Jeffrey Nichols and Will Bagley of Playing with Shadows, Voices of Dissent in the Mormon West, a forthcoming volume in Will's Kingdom of the West series to be published by Arthur H. Clarke. I was a reader for Arthur H. Clarke when her manuscript about her great-great-uncle Peter McCausland was under consideration, and I quickly ran out of superlatives about the depth of her research, the breadth of her compassion, and the rigorous intellectual effort bent on understanding Utah's most explosive period, when Mormonism itself reeled under the impact of repeated blows, most of them self-inflicted. Peter McCausland, who had joined the church in Scotland in 1848, brought his family to Utah in 1854 and left it 5 years later with a military escort. Those intervening years include poverty and privation that did not stop short of actual starvation, while demands and exactions from priesthood leaders intensified. That period also included the 1856 Reformation, the inhuman suffering of the handcart pioneers, and the horror, suspicion, and rage that exploded out of control at Mountain Meadows, followed by equal terror and suspicion, but more control, during the handling of the protracted Utah War. Polly's book is particularly important not only in helping its readers understand why Peter McCausland made a principled and ethical decision to take his extended family to California as soon as it was practical, but also illuminates the broader dynamic of defection, which I interpret as the internal knowledge that each person can accumulate only for himself or herself about where the tipping point is away from instead of toward an institution. Commenting on these books, and I've introduced the participants in inverse order, is Kurt Bench, the owner and proprietor of Benchmark Books, whose business has greatly benefited from the fact that the church no longer wants my tithing, hence increasing my book buying income. If you haven't had the pleasure of talking books and writing checks with Kurt and with his knowledgeable son, Chris, skip the next session and head for the book room. Kurt describes his work as buying, selling, and appraising Mormon and Utah-related rare books, documents, and artifacts, but he will also admit under duress that he actually reads books and reread both of today's works under discussion. He published and wrote the foreword to the first Mormon book, A Celebration of the 1830 Book of Mormon, with an additional leaf. Besides authoring the introduction to two other books, he has written several articles primarily about books, and including 50 important Mormon books. My printer was getting really faint here. For the October 1990 issue of Sunstone. Kurt has reviewed numerous books for different journals and for several years wrote a book column in Currents, a quarterly publication of the Utah State Historical Society Division of State History. So we'll hear first from Kurt, second from Gary's attempt to defend himself, and then Polly's graciousness, which will make defense unnecessary, and then we'll have questions from the audience.
When Levina started to stumble there with her words, I was really afraid of what she had done was to turn the page and find out that she was looking at the reverse of her introduction, because as some of you may know, she's very green and she never uses a blank sheet of paper. She always prints on the side of one she's already used. So when she sends you your edited version of whatever it is, you have to be hope that they're all in order, because you don't know whether it's her light bill on the other side or something else that she's been working on. So I was afraid maybe she was going to start reading something she had been editing recently. If you wondered why I looked a little nervous during her introduction, it had nothing to do with my speaking. It had to do with the fact that she had precariously balanced two of the books that I have paid for on the edge of the podium here, and I was certain that at least one of them was going to take a tumble, and then one of you would be able to buy it for a bargain, I guess.
I tried.
The idea of this session was originally proposed to the Mormon History Association earlier this year, which was held in Independence, Missouri. But it was gently rejected. I've been trying to decide if we were turned down by them and accepted by Sunstone, because MHA has higher standards and Sunstone standards are lower. Wasn't sure which, but either way, we're happy to be here. You've already been told about the nebulous religious status of our two authors. They are Mormics. Which, Bill, you looked a little puzzled by that. Combination of Mormon and Catholic. I asked them if they weren't actually Morlocks, the futuristic race of ape-like humanoids who ate the defenseless and passive Eloi, humans whom they treated as cattle. I feared they might view this lone Mormon as a potential entree. You know, if you've been to many of these, it's usually the reverse of what it is today. You have a number of critics and one author, and you do notice that the odds are in their favor. Two authors and one critic. So I decided that I better not be too critical, since I'm outnumbered by the Morlocks. I feel it necessary to say at the outset that despite popular opinion and ample evidence to the contrary, I don't consider myself a scholar or an academic. That's where you're supposed to laugh. I am first a bibliophile who has loved books since first being able to read, about the fifth grade, second time. I'm also a historiophile. Lavina, is that a neologism? Who has always loved the reading and studying of history of many types, but especially that of the Mormon Church and the American West. Thirdly, I am a longtime bookseller who unabashedly loves to promote and sell books. So please understand that I view books through the above lenses. And not only can I not help it, but I don't apologize for it either. I have written many book reviews and articles for several publications. Most of them have not been the detailed, ultra-critical book reviews that you find in reputable publications. In fact, I'm thinking of one that was that reviewed Gary's book, but I probably won't talk a whole lot about that. Most of them have not, as I say, have been maybe in the traditional sense of being a long critical review. They've more often been written to make people aware of books and their strengths, reasons to pick up the books and read them, and yes, sometimes even buy them. But I assure you, the fact that we have copies of these books for sale down the hall is merely a coincidence. More often than not, I have shared my enthusiasm for and enjoyment of these books. Also, many of the books I reviewed were written by authors whom I consider friends. And I include Polly and Gary in that group, and I find it difficult to be overly critical of my friends. I admire those scholars with the professional detachment necessary to critically evaluate their colleagues' writing and maintain their collegiality. I hope I can provide such professionalism here and still have these two be willing to go to lunch with me sometime if I buy it. Both copies of the book are signed, she points out, and if if we have books down there that aren't signed, they will be soon. In considering how to go about critiquing two very different books, I wondered if I should first look for similarities. I immediately noticed something besides the obvious, that they were both biographies written by Moritz. They were both published by the Arthur H. Clarke Company, an imprint of the University of Oklahoma Press. More importantly, they each were printed on paper that, and I quote, meets the guidelines for permanence and durability of the Committee on Production, guidelines for book longevity of the Council on Library and Resources Incorporated. And you can't make stuff like that up. Any other similarities pale in comparison, so in the limited time that I have, I'll just briefly examine each book in turn and make separate comments. In 2003, Gary Topping had a book published that Levina alluded to, Utah Historians and the Reconstruction of Western History. It contains an insightful analysis of five prominent Utah historians that she also mentioned, Fawn Brody, Bernard DeVoto, Juanita Brooks, Dale Morgan, and Wallace Stegner. Topping wanted to include a chapter on Leonard Arrington, but was not able to at the time. This book, here, was written to fill that gap. It is not a full-fledged biography, although the title does not necessarily make that clear. However, as Topping clearly notes at the beginning of the book, rather, the emphasis is on the historian's life, and not much on other aspects of Arrington's long and productive life and career. He states in the preface, most of our interest in the historian, I think, lies in his historical work rather than his personal life. So while I have not shunned consideration of purely personal matters, I have tried to keep consistently in mind that this is, as the title promises, a historian's life. And I have tried to pare such considerations down to those that bear directly on his work. He goes on to point out that the book is, quote, an essay in historiography, not bibliography, and acknowledges that while Arrington's output was prodigious, or is it prodigious? it varied in quality and significance. Topping says he confines his attention to those works that strike him as most important and which best allow him to make the points he wants to make. In chapter 2, Topping writes with great sensitivity about three epiphanies, profound mystical experiences that Arrington had while relatively young that greatly influenced him in his religious life, his choice of a career, and the general direction of his life. The first occurred after he read Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, about which Arrington wrote that, quote, it was not so much a book about religious experience as it was a novel whose very reading was a religious experience. Arrington later described this transcendent spiritual experience and the enormous impact it had on the formulation of his life's work. For me, Arrington's accounts of these transforming experiences are quite moving and powerful. Further, Topping's non-judgmental and perceptive analysis of those events and the influence on Leonard Arrington impressed me that he knows his subject and is sensitive to the importance of the motivating influences in Arrington's life. Topping recognizes that, quote, somehow those epiphanies seem to have kindled an interior fire that powered one of the most energetic careers in American historiography. In subsequent chapters, Topping selectively critiques some of Arrington's many books, some of which he praises and others takes issue with, or both. He spends an entire chapter on Arrington's magnum opus, Great Basin Kingdom, which Topping clearly admires, calling it, quote, one of the greatest single works ever produced on Mormon history and an acknowledged classic of Western historiography, but is not hesitant to point out several of what he considers shortcomings of the book. At least one reviewer of Topping's book opines that his, quote, insightful critique of Great Basin Kingdom is good as far as it goes, but then he says he did not explore enough aspects and topics of the book. For the most part, Topping does not seem overly impressed with Arrington's biographies of such figures as Charles C. Rich, David Eccles, Harold Silver, Madeline Silver, and William Spry. His criticisms of these books include the fact that they are vanity books, largely commissioned by family members who wanted the best sides of the subjects brought to the fore. In addition, almost all of them were written in part or entirely by research assistants with varying degrees of interpretive and literary skills. He also feels that Arrington's natural tendency, for the most part, to see only the best in his subjects and to neglect facing their shortcomings is a serious limiting factor in his biographies. One notable exception in this category is from Quaker to Latter-day Saint, Bishop Edmund B. Woolley, which turns out to have been largely written by Rebecca Cornwall, hired by Arrington to do the heavy lifting on the book, which he did admirably. Topping obviously thinks so. His praise for Cornwall's research and writing are unfailingly effusive, generally more so than for Arrington's. At first, Topping was irritated by the almost inevitable assistance or even collaboration of co-workers and assistants in the writing of Arrington's books, but then grew to, quote, admire and perhaps even envy the cooperative and communal system that encouraged it. Arrington's major biography, Brigham Young, American Moses, published by prestigious Alfred A. Knopf in 1985, receives mainly faint praise and some fairly severe criticism from Topping. He feels that, quote, the shortcomings of the book were almost as conspicuous as its virtues. Listing its failure to employ any psychology or serious probing into difficult events, issues, and questions. He decries what he perceives as Arrington's softening of Young's image, going so far as to say that his emphasis on Brigham's softer nature is disingenuous. Although Topping calls the book, quote, by far the most extensive biography of the great Mormon leader yet to appear, he declares it cannot be called definitive because of Arrington's insistence on creating a more positive image of Young and his neglect in balancing it with an equally frank examination of the dark side. One reviewer comes to Arrington's defense and concludes that, quote, Leonard Arrington liked Brigham Young, but Gary Topping apparently does not. However, one cannot say that Gary Topping does not like Leonard Arrington. Indeed, he clearly admires him and praises his positive qualities and accomplishments throughout the book. He, along with many others, agrees that Leonard Arrington is, quote, universally regarded as the greatest of all Mormon historians. However, Topping is not at all hesitant to point out what he sees as weaknesses and flaws in Arrington's work, and does so with perhaps more vigor than some feel he should. In light of that fact, I was amused to read one reviewer's assessment that Topping's biography is, quote, generous, even at times hagiographic. I know what the word means, I just don't know how to say it. I will grant that it certainly is a sympathetic portrait, but it is anything but hagiography. Faring much better in Topping's estimation are the later histories, consisting of, perhaps surprisingly, the little-known Beet Sugar in the West, Building the City of God, Community and Cooperation Among the Mormons, and the very successful and highly regarded The Mormon Experience, A History of the Latter-day Saints. Other chapters in the book provide an insightful discussion of the 10 so-called Camelot years of the Church History Division that Arrington headed, its ultimate closure and move to Provo, and Arrington's significant role in the encouraging and promotion of the, quote, new Mormon history, his liberal religious philosophy, and his views on how Mormon history should be written by himself and by others. Anyone who has read my reviews of Gary Topping's book knows that I enjoyed it, and I consider it to be an important volume on the life and contributions of Leonard Arrington. That is not to say it is without flaw. Topping's book has been reviewed several times with mixed results. Two, who were Arrington's friends and colleagues, noted Topping's high points, but felt he was sometimes unfair or inaccurate in his assessment of Arrington's work and did not give him enough credit for some of his efforts. One admitted his biased observation, saying he loves Arrington as a friend and mentor, and that had he written an Arrington biography, he would have been more favorable toward him. I relate to that sentiment, since not only did Leonard influence me enormously in my discovery, study, and love of Mormon history, but was a good friend and supporter as well. Another reviewer says Topping was not willing to look at the other side of the story of the disbanding of Arrington's history division, seeing Arrington and his co-workers only as victims of unfair treatment at the hands of church authorities. Generally, I feel Topping tries to be fair and accurate in his analysis and assessment of Arrington's work, but once in a while, he slips up. Occasionally, his personal sentiments overcome his neutrality and uses pejorative terms for certain LDS leaders, such as rock-ribbed right-winger. And red-baiter. Fortunately, epithets like these are rare in his generally even-handed approach. He mistakenly calls Elder G. Homer Durham an apostle. Doesn't mean he didn't want to be, but that was very off the cuff, and it should be stricken from the cites the drinking of Coca-Cola as a violation of the word of wisdom, although admittedly some think it is, but probably the line that stretches from the church office building to the local store with it sells caffeinated beverages would be evidence that a lot don't think it's a violation. And he states that, quote, all general authorities are entitled to make doctrinal pronouncements on behalf of the church. Again, some may wish they could, but these relatively minor and infrequent errors can probably be chalked up to Topping's Mormonism. I find it amazing that there are not more such mistakes, given the fact that he does not have an LDS background in education. And I must admit that I'm glad I'm not the biographer here. I can only imagine how daunting it would be to write the story of the foremost Mormon historian of our time, and at the same time, a respected and admired colleague. Such a book is bound to invite close scrutiny and criticism, and it did. Although Gary Topping's book is not, and was not intended to be, the full-scale biography of Leonard Arrington some hoped it would be, it is nevertheless an informative and important view of Arrington as a writer and historian. Another respected historian we all know, Greg Prince, is currently at work on a comprehensive biography of Leonard Arrington. Topping's book should be read first as an extension of his earlier book, Utah Historians and the Reconstruction of Western History, and also as a valuable companion volume to Arrington's indispensable memoir, Adventures of a Church Historian. That was pretty easy on you, wasn't it, Gary?
Yeah, that's right. I'll have my chance later.
We'll see who buys lunch. Over the 3+ decades as a bookseller, I have seen many books written about a Mormon ancestor, usually by a well-meaning descendant whose writing skills are marginal and historical training non-existent. The result is often mediocre hagiography at best. Balance and accuracy are not only absent, but hardly even strived for. It is rare indeed to see such an even-handed, well-written, and even riveting life story as Polly Aird's Mormon convert, Mormon defector. The subject of the book, Peter McCausland, born in 1824 near Glasgow, Scotland, and I can't resist this, Polly, is Aird's great-great-uncle. Of course, Polly has a significant advantage over the above amateur biographers. She's a first-rate, award-winning, independent historian, and a Morlick, no less, who's been writing Mormon history for many years. I wasn't really going to do that, but I couldn't resist. I do other accents for money later. You might expect by looking at the book's title that it may be yet another anti-Mormon expose, but you would be quite mistaken. True, it does contain the story of one man's departure from the Mormon faith within a decade of embracing it, but it has so much more, and therein lies the value of the book. It is not until the second half of the book that Peter McCausland gets from Scotland to America and on to the Mormon Zion in Utah Territory in 1854, 7 months after leaving England, sailing across the Atlantic, steaming up rivers, and walking 1,200 miles overland. Before we reach the book's midway point, when the McCausland's reach Utah, too long, complains one reviewer. Air takes us from Loch Lomond to the Glasgow area where the McCausland and his family work in the textile trade, along with many other working class Scots who struggle for survival under abominable conditions. Eric paints a grim but compelling picture of the working and living conditions there which the McCausland's and their countrymen endured. Mormon missionaries from America began their proselytizing efforts in Scotland in 1839, and Peter, an avid reader, this got my attention, undoubtedly read some of the many pamphlets with which they blanketed the British Isles. After receiving a personal vision confirming the truth of Mormonism from McCausland, he and several family members are converted and soon are caught up in the fervor to gather design, now located in Utah Territory. Following behind some of his family members who had joined the Mormons, Peter, his wife, and her brother set sail for America, and after several weeks of sometimes hellish conditions on the ocean and later on the river from New Orleans, finally arrive in Kansas City. From there, they begin their 1,200-mile overland journey, arriving in Utah in late September 1854. Unfortunately, neither Peter nor Agnes kept any record of their upriver or overland trek. However, as she so often does in this story, which often lacks firsthand accounts of the principal individuals, Aird makes skillful and frequent use of other primary sources, many from the LDS Church archives, and reliable secondary sources when needed to fill in the gaps and keep the narrative accurate and moving. She draws a vivid picture of how it must have been for these fledgling converts as they journey to their promised land, which, as we soon discover, is not the religious paradise they had envisioned. The first blow to their newfound faith actually came before they left for the States, when the doctrine and practice of polygamy was announced in the Millennial Star. More profound shocks soon followed. The McCausland's arrived in Utah at a very difficult time. The 5 years they lived there before leaving the church and the territory for California in 1859 were tumultuous ones. In addition to suffering through drought, famine, and locust infestation, the McCausland's had to try to endure the human excesses and behavior in a hostile and sometimes violent political and religious environment. Almost one after another, more traumatic events occurred in Utah during those years. In 1856, the McCausland's learned of the fate of the Willie and Martin Handcart Companies, during which the greatest loss of life on the Overland Trail occurred. Early the next year in Springville, only a few miles away from where they lived, two disaffected Mormon men by the name of Parrish were murdered, allegedly by order of the local bishop, in an act labeled by some as blood atonement. Later, other similar killings took place there or nearby. This was during the Reformation, during which some general and local church authorities often used fiery rhetoric and stern measures to condemn sin and stamp out perceived backsliding and apostasy among the saints. An atmosphere of fear and mistrust prevailed. Polygamy was emphasized, and obedience to church leaders was demanded by some. Added to this volatile mix was the news of the imminent invasion by federal forces and that fall of the horrific massacre of an entire wagon train at Mountain Meadows. The Utah War followed, in which Peter McCausland reluctantly participated as a militiaman. All of these events took a terrible emotional and spiritual toll on McCausland and many others. Peter's faith was shaken, his doubts grew, and he chafed under what he saw as the authoritarian rule and lack of prophetic ability of Brigham Young. There was considerable pressure from certain apostles to prune the dead limbs from the church, meaning those persons who had apostatized or were worthy to be cut off from the church. The editor of the anti-Mormon newspaper, The Valley Tan, reported in November 1858 that figuratively, let's hope, the heads of 250 such persons were cut off, and Aird writes, one of those heads belonged to Peter McCausland. But again, McCausland is maddeningly silent during the critical year of 1858, leaving no written record of his thought or events, including his excommunication. But this time, Aird is not able to provide any specific information about this church action or its immediate effect on McCausland's. As frustrating as this is in places in the book, one certainly cannot blame her for the lack of primary documents. Her bibliography and footnotes amply show she searched long and hard for and used them whenever possible. However, one reviewer believes Aird's, quote, speculation concerning McCausland's reactions to various events is occasionally overdone, and says some of it should have been cut from the manuscript, or she should have provided specific evidence to support the nexus between general events and Peter's reactions to them. That aside, I should mention that that particular reviewer misspelled McCausland through his entire review, so what's it? I found that rather funny and ironic. That aside, McCausland's knew it was not safe to remain in the territory branded as apostates, and he and others inside and outside of his family began to make plans to leave. Other family members elected to remain in the faith and in the territory. Early the next summer, McCausland and other families left Utah in the protection of a U.S. Army escort and traveled to Northern California's Sacramento Valley. There, Peter settled down to an uneventful farming life, but also enthusiastically embraced spiritualism, which he believed was superior to any religion. Aird points out that McCausland's later beliefs closely paralleled those of the Godbeites in Utah, who believed in spiritualism and concluded that Brigham Young had abused his power. Although Peter McCausland did not leave a contemporary record of his departure from Mormonism, he later wrote long letters to a sister and a Scottish friend whom he had baptized, in which he details some of the reasons he left and arguments for why the Bible and Book of Mormon could not be inspired of God. He lists some of the causes of his defection. One was finding, to his disappointment, that Brigham Young was no more inspired than many other men outside of Mormondom. He condemns the doctrine of doing as you're told, whether it appears to you to be right or wrong. I should have done that in Scottish accent. As well as the black and white thinking that produced the definition of enemies of the church that says, quote, all who are not for us are against us. And furthermore, can be dealt with violently, such as the parishes of Springville were. He also decries the excesses of the Reformation and the practice of polygamy. Surprisingly, though, McCausland never expresses bitterness or ill feeling toward the Mormon people. In fact, he praises their devotion and sincerity. He expresses feelings of charity toward the honest among them. He generally does not try to dissuade his Mormon readers from their beliefs or persuade them to believe as he does. He tells his convert friend to, quote, prove it for yourself and not depend upon my experience in Mormonism. Aird notes that Peter, quote, did not dwell on his experiences in Utah that made him leave the religion, nor did he speak out in books or lectures in an effort to expose the crimes he believed the church hierarchy had authorized. Peter McCausland was an ordinary man who had never achieved wealth or fame or occupied any great position in or out of the Mormon church. In his foreword to the book, William McKinnon says that while McCausland's life story is, quote, that of an unexceptional person, that is not to say it is an uninteresting one. He goes on, nonetheless, Peter McCausland was a man with an extraordinary experience, that of first loving and then leaving Mormonism, a religion that has usually chronicled the adventures of the faithful rather than shedding light on those it labels Gentile or apostate. Studying his story is therefore eminently worthwhile. He adds that the label of apostate is accepted neither by McCausland nor his biographer. McKinnon further observes Aird, a non-Mormon, he's apparently unaware of the proper term Morlick, limbs this view deftly and in balanced fashion while avoiding the grinding of anti-LDS axes, a tone not always achieved by historians and biographers surveying the world built by a rough-hewn Brigham Young. As I searched the many reviews of Pauli's books, published both in print and online, I found almost exclusively positive comments, none of which do I disagree with. Here is a selection. Poliere does a beautiful job balancing graceful prose with a dignified, neutral tone in analyzing the relevant ideas and events in the lives of the McCausland's and the Mormon community. And from a fellow McCausland descendant, Poliere's book was a wonderful surprise, although it was pushed on to me as required reading as a direct but distant relative of Peter McCausland. Her book is not a sentimental retelling of the McCausland clan, but a meticulous history with real bite. Like her subject, Aird evidently believes that every person has the right and duty to choose for himself his spiritual course. Polly Aird has given us the portrait of a thoughtful man who yearned for transcendence but insisted upon reason, evidence, and the exercise of free agency. Polly Aird has provided us with a fresh and balanced approach to Mormon biography, telling the story of a type of person and a subject we don't often hear or read about. Or if we do, it is usually couched in polemical language. I welcome her contributions to Mormon history and hope there are more to come. I'm quite honored to have been asked to comment on these two books written by two fine scholars who have proven themselves time and again in the arena of Mormon historiography. I have long been impressed by these two outsiders looking in, as they have examined with notable detachment and fairness the complex milieu that is Mormonism. Their writing remains free of the anti-LDS bias or sentiment that is too often evident in the works of so many authors outside the Mormon religion. 20 years ago, I gave a paper at Sunstone called 50 Important Mormon Books. And by the way, I have a few of those available at our book. No, they're no cost. And we can make more copies, but for anyone who's interested. It was, as she mentioned, it was published in Sunstone, in which I included the category written by what I call sympathetic non-Mormon authors, among whom were Thomas L. Kane, Richard F. Burton, Thomas O'Day, and Wallace Stegner. Today, I would need to add to that group, along with several other current and important such writers, the names of Gary Topping and Polly Aird.
My comments will be quite brief today, basically because I think that was a very generous, fair, even to the point of generous critique, and I have little, if anything, to disagree with or even comment upon. So I'll make my comments quite brief, and we want to hear from you guys. I'd like to begin by just offering a couple of gentle modifications to Levina's introduction. First of all, I find it uncomfortable to be referred to as a devout Catholic. I will own up to being a practicing Catholic, but being devout is when you have one of these little lights over your head. I'm a long ways away from that. Polly's a lot closer to that than I am, I can assure you. So anyway, there's that. And also, at the time Levina prepared her comments, characterizing me as a professor of history at Salt Lake Community College was accurate. However, now I am privileged to add retired professor of history to that. So there's that little modification. When a historian's career moves from studying and teaching history into the realms of writing and publishing, he eventually encounters two types of people previously unknown to him: editors and reviewers. Of the two, I've always found editors much the easiest to work with, because the author actually does get to work with them in the process of turning a manuscript into a publishable book. It is true that some of the best editors, particularly those named Levina, Fielding, or Anderson, have an amazing ability to ask the most damnably difficult questions about a manuscript, such that the poor author is driven to distraction to try to answer them, but in the end, a better manuscript is the inevitable result. I think I've only worked on one project with Levina, but boy, that was literary boot camp for me. Reviewers are a whole different story. They are not more difficult to deal with than editors. They are impossible to deal with. Their work appears after the author's work is done, and there's no way he can either dispute the reviewer's comments or incorporate them if he agrees with them. Unless, of course, the book goes to a second edition, which is a pleasure I've never had and never will. You can always write letters to the editor, of course, as if you've seen the current Journal of Mormon History, about the first third of the magazine, I think, is authors writing and complaining about how they've been mistreated by reviewers. I've never done that. Fortunately, my books have generally drawn favorable reviews, so dealing with reviewers hasn't been much of an issue with me. On those occasions when I have gotten a review that seemed to come from outer space, I have held my peace, in the confidence that the good sense of readers will supply the appropriate adjustment. Today, though, since Kurt has elected to comment not only on my book, but also on the reviews, I feel obligated for the first time to break my silence and respond to the reviews as well as to Kurt. Responding to Kurt is the easiest and happiest of the two tasks. His comments today are actually the third time he has reviewed my book, the first time being in the newsletter of the Utah Westerners, and the other a formal review in the Utah Historical Quarterly. I think I'm the one who owes you lunch, Kurt, for valiant endurance, if nothing else. How you can do that. Kurt's reviews and the one by Henry Wolfinger have made me as happy as any reviews of any of my books I've ever done. And it is not because they contain almost relentless praise, but rather because these two reviewers took the trouble to understand exactly what I was trying to accomplish and to evaluate the degree to which I succeeded. I would happily have accepted negative assessments if they had shown that I had fallen short of my stated goals. Other reviewers were not as perceptive. Greg Prince, for example, took me to task for not having written the books he himself is writing. I thought, gee, that you should be grateful. No, as Kurt understands, my book is not the exhaustive life and times biography Greg apparently contemplates, but rather a sequel to my Utah Historians, which attempted to establish only a biographical context for their historical writings. It is not an essay in biography, but rather one in historiography. It is no more the definitive biography of Leonard Darrington than the previous book was of Juanita Brooks, Bernard DeVoto, or the others. Greg has a perfect right to produce any kind of book he wants, and in fact, I have sent him in electronic form all of my Arrington notes in hopes that they might ease his task a bit. But I had a different goal. Jim Allen took me to task for not interpreting the Mountain Meadows Massacre in the light of Turley, Walker, and Leonard, whose book, in fact, appeared after mine was already in print. But thanks, Jim. In the future, I'll try to be a little more clairvoyant. I might agree with Jim that my treatment of Brigham Young's role in that awful event was a little harsh. At that time, I was still under the sway of Will Bagley. And I've still been trying to extricate myself from that, Will, but I haven't been able to do it, so I really did it. But I will not retract my negative interpretation of American Moses, Arrington's Brigham Young biography. As I think I say in the book, Leonard Arrington's Brigham Young looks a lot more like Leonard Arrington than the Lion of the Lord. As my Mormon brother-in-law asked me, how could Leonard write a 400-page biography of Brigham Young and never once mention blood atonement? You can check this out for yourself when you get home. But the book's index contains an entry for buffalo chips, but none on blood atonement. That would be my definition of a skewed biography, and I rest my case. My Mormon brother-in-law, Joel Allred, is sitting right over here. I paid him at the beginning of the session to come and tell me I had a long-distance call so I wouldn't have to endure this, but he didn't get your signal. Kurt says that occasionally my personal sentiments overcome my neutrality, and refers to my calling a certain LDS leader a rock-ribbed right-winger and a red-baiter. As I recall, it was Ernest L. Wilkinson to whom I was referring, and if so, I hasten to repent of such moderation. I should have employed much more vigorous expressions.
First, I want to thank Kurt and Levina for their comments, and then I have a comment about the term Morlach, the small group of Catholics who ended up studying Mormons for one reason or another. So we thought, we need some kind of name for ourselves. So we tried Cathmon, but somehow that didn't have the nice lilt that Morlach has. And in the interest of full disclosure, the Morlocks are also known as the Early Day Saints. Kirk brings up several points relating to Mormon biographies. He started out his critique of my book by saying that over many decades as a bookseller, he has seen few books written about Mormon ancestors that were even-handed and well-written, much less riveting. He credits my handling the story of my great-great-uncle, Peter McGoslin, to my being a historian and having written Mormon history for many years. That experience no doubt gives me a great advantage, but I think there is another factor, perhaps equally important in this case, and that is, I am not LDS. I did not stand at my mother's knee listening to stories about my heroic pioneer ancestors who had suffered from repeated persecutions and sacrificed to travel to a land set aside for them, there to build the kingdom of God. When, as a teenager, I first heard about how the McGoslins converted to Mormonism, came to Utah, and then escaped under the protection of an army escort, I reacted with interest and curiosity. Here was a story about a family who had emigrated from Scotland to the new Mormon Zion with great expectations of living near their prophet, only to have their hopes dashed once they arrived. It was the story of hope and disillusionment that fascinated me, and the fact that they were ancestors was of secondary importance. This adds up to 2 points. First, that I was never interested in bashing the church, for what intrigued me was the human story of giving your all to a belief, and then for some reason losing that belief. Secondly, that although not being LDS allowed me to come at this story with more objectivity, I think faithful members can write equally balanced and accurate biographies, but they have more traditions and obstacles to overcome. Perhaps this is where a maturing faith comes in, for it requires a willingness to look at one's subject with an increasingly critical eye. This means moving beyond faith-promoting books and accepting a more complex history, one with gray areas, ambiguities, and unforeseen outcomes. A maturing faith also means that one is not afraid to learn from those who decide to leave. Why did they go? What can we learn from their reasons? What might we have done to address their issues? Turning now to the challenges I faced in writing this biography, Kurt mentioned that one reviewer found fault with my using the subjunctive voice when I could only surmise a particular emotion, as I had no record of how Peter McGoslin felt, only circumstantial evidence. The reviewer wrote that he thought I should have cut such phrases as, quote, "This new life must have caused anxiety." I can understand his point, but without primary source material, I did not have much choice if Peter McGoslin was to come alive. While mulling this over, Gary Topping alerted me to the advice Wallace Stegner gave to Leonard Arrington, which Gary alludes to in his book. Arrington had sought Stegner's help as he struggled with a commissioned but family contentious biography of David Eccles. Stegner wrote in one part, quote, "I'd play up that Miss Train in Hannibal, and I'd play it up from David's point of view. If you haven't any record of how he felt to see that train pulling out and leaving him in a strange town, in a strange country, guess, put it in the subjunctive. Not, quote, David watched the train departing, etc., but David would have watched." Thus, with all due respect to the reviewer of my book, I think I'll stick with Stegner's guidance. In framing this story and thinking about how to highlight the factors that shaped Peter McGoslin's life, I knew I could not simply recount that this thing happened, then that happened, and so on. Instead, I came up with 3 questions I wanted to answer. What had attracted Peter to Mormonism in Scotland? What had led to his disillusionment in Utah? And finally, did he later fill the spiritual vacuum in his life with something else? It was these questions that shaped the structure of the book. One decision I had to make at the start was how much background to include. Historian Tom Alexander told me that there should be just enough to tell the story. But to tell this story, I found I needed to go into much greater detail about Scotland than Tom probably would have. Stegner again gave advice on this point to Errington for his treatment of David Eccles, who also came from poverty-stricken, industrializing Scotland. Stegner wrote, quote, "There's a generalization to be made, that when their hope of getting to Zion was finally realized, they discovered that Utah was not Eden or Happy Valley, that it was almost as hard a place to make a living as Scotland had been. That needs to be explained. That's where we need a little more context." To explain what attracted Peter and his family to the new faith, and then tell about his life there as a new convert, I found I needed to spend more time in Scotland, as it was integral to the book, and not just background. My initial challenge in writing this biography was that I had very few primary sources to work with. Peter McCausland never held religious, economic, or political power in Scotland, Utah, or California. There were occasional references to him or family members in the LDS records of members in the various places they lived in Scotland, as they had moved from one place to another seeking work and had been converted to Mormonism 5 years before they emigrated. There was the passenger manifest for the ship they sailed on. And again, once in Salt Lake City, they show up in the record of members in the 19th Ward. And when they moved to Spanish Fork in late 1856, in the membership records there. What became invaluable to me were the diaries kept by fellow LDS members in Scotland, and then on the same ship they traveled on, the steamboats up the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, and across the plains. I also searched out cousins I did not know, descendants of those family members who remained in Utah, and finally struck gold in Blanding, where the great-granddaughter of one of Peter McCausland's sisters lived. In the 1880s, her family had their home on the banks of the San Juan River above Bluff. But in 1884, a flood completely washed them out. One of the few items they were able to rescue was a strongbox containing letters and photographs, including a few letters from Peter. Over the years on vacations, my daughters and I camped along the route the family had taken in crossing the plains, and later I traveled with a friend up the Mississippi River on one trip, and from Salt Lake City to the Sacramento Valley on another, again following Peter's route. On that latter trip, I checked the phone book in the town where he had settled to see if any family members still live there. I picked the oddest name I had from that branch of the family, a man named Ansel Miller. When I called him and explained who I was, he told me his daughter was very interested in the contents of the trunk. "Trunk?" I asked. "What trunk?" "Oh, it's the trunk belonging to Peter McCausland with all of his books and writings." Needless to say, it was that trunk and its contents that eventually made this book possible, that gave a voice to Peter McCausland. Peter never became an anti-Mormon. He never wrote or spoke against the church. In a letter to his friend in Scotland, written about a year after he left Utah, he said, quote, "It is not at all," and I don't have your good Scottish accent. Maybe when you read this. "It is not at all according to my feelings to write on this subject, and I would not have troubled you now had you not, along with others, requested me to write you on this subject." He added, "That I might put no stumbling block in your path, I might add that I do know that there are many just as good men as I would wish to associate with, whose experience in Mormonism has made them stronger in the faith. And I must say that my feelings are very charitable toward them as a people, that is to those who are honest in the faith." On the book's dedication page, I have included a quotation from the English author George Eliot, which captures for me why writing about everyday people can be so satisfying. She said, "The things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been, is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. I hope in this book I have freed Peter McAuslin from his grave for a short while to tell us his experiences during a particularly dramatic time in both Scotland and Utah.
We are completely out of time for questions, and since we couldn't possibly accuse any of these participants of being long-winded, it's your fault for laughing so much. Thank you.